I love the book of Job. Though it is what they consider a book of poetry, there are so many life lessons out of that book. But there's one thing that a lot of times I think we overlook in the book of Job, and that is the hypocrite. The 27th chapter of Job in verse 8, there's a sharp question that comes from a man who is in a lot of personal pain and in deep affliction. Then he says, "For what is the hope of a hypocrite, though he has gained when God takes away his soul?" I think what we can get from Job and what he has truly learned through all of his pain and affliction was that the wicked will only momentarily prosper, but the truly righteous are eternally blessed. We can find similar passages in Hebrews chapter 11, the 37th Psalm, the 84th Psalm, that the pleasures of sin are seasonal, where spiritual values are eternal. Every place we look in the Bible, the wages of sin never vary. It's always the same. Contrasting that, the joys of serving God always increase and radiate and even embellish the halls of heaven. There is a definite contrast in two scriptures, Isaiah chapter 57, verse 21, Romans 8, verse 35. Isaiah 57, it says, "There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked." Where in Romans 8, 35, it says, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ?" Christ made it clear in Mark chapter 8, verse 36, where he said, though a person gains the whole world, he would be a loser if his soul were forfeited. These are my words, a process of mundane glory. Losing the soul just so that you can have the whole world. Of course, I guess you can take from the title, we're going to talk about hypocrisy. The hope of a hypocrite. Is there really hope for that hypocrite? Hypocrisy. I guess in four short words, you can define it as the antithesis of sincerity. It's kind of like actors in a play. But hypocrisy is played out in human life, the drama of human life, where you have phony people who disguise their real intentions behind the masks of pretense and sanctimonious tones. Just as an actor, you take the Brad Pitts and some of these other guys out there, if you put them in truly the dangerous situations that they face, they'll die. They won't make it to the end of the movie. They're playing characters. The same for a hypocrite. He's playing the character. It is really a rare find to find a genuine Christian who is a genuine Christian in trying times. During those years, centuries ago, when the persecution against Christians was so great, that there was a group of people who rose up who refused to fellowship with anyone who denied Christ under duress. They were called the Donatists. And while they had a, I think maybe a too a severe attitude towards it, they at least disdained hypocrisy. If you say you're this, then be this. We don't often find and categorize hypocrisy, but there are some characteristics or some categories of hypocrites. And I want to spend just a little time this evening to see what sins are attached to the evil of hypocrisy. Since Job tells us that God will take away the soul of the pretender in religion, we must be careful that we don't fall into that realm. Hypocrites have no hope. And we truly desire, as Christians, and we try, I truly believe within this congregation, we try to be who we say we are. We strive very much for that. I think we would all love to be categorized in the same group of people as Timothy and Lois and Eunice in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. Paul gave these three individuals glowing accolades because of their sincerity. They possessed, verse 5 says, an unfeigned faith. The sin of speech. I think this first one really pulls the hypocrite right out into the open. There are three verses in the scriptures that pretty much tell us the same thing. Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 31, James 1, verse 26, and Matthew 7, 21. They speak of the same results of showing much love with their mouths while their heart goes after covetousness. To claim to be religious, and I think this is probably one of the big downfalls of Christianity and why people kind of say it or think it with a bad taste in their mouth. It's because they associate themselves with people who wear the title but who don't bridle the tongue. This is true vanity, especially in the sight of God. When we just mouth the words, Lord, Lord, but our heart is saying and thinking and doing other things, the only path that it leads to is destruction. We may have others fooled, but we can't fool God. I was reading several articles over the past several weeks, and as I was preparing my lesson, a couple sentences popped out in my head that I had read earlier, and I tried to go back to find the source, and I couldn't. So I don't want you to know these aren't my words. They're from someone else, but I can't find it to give the true credit for. But I was reading one sentence, and it said, exchanging obedience for verbosity is the poor choice of many as they attempt to deceive the very one who made them. And I thought that fell so much into line with the sin of speech. It's because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to deceive. But there's one we can't deceive. Again, another part that I had read, it was from a poet. And I was going back, and I must have spent an hour or so going back through the stuff that I was reading and still couldn't find it. And he says here, you can advertise your virtues. You can self-achievement laud. You can boast yourself as somebody. But you can't fool God. Is there any reason why God thought it was important for Paul to write to Titus and demand that our speech adorn sound doctrine? Titus 2 and verse 1. one of the most beautiful portraits of speech comes from Proverbs 25. A portrait of words properly spoken. But where do our words come from? They come from our thoughts. Where do our thoughts come from? They come from our hearts. Jesus, in Matthew 12, verse 34, he says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. You know, a lot of times we try to excuse what we say as a slip of the tongue. Why'd the tongue slip? Is it icy? Did somebody squirt some oil in the mouth? No, it slipped because that's what we were thinking. They like to use it as a Freudian slip when we say things we shouldn't say sometimes. But a lot of times it's hard to keep that tongue from wagging when the thoughts behind it are pushing it out of the mouth. Psalms 141 and verse 3, David said, set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth, keep the door of my lips. Some of the most prolific hypocrites on the face of the earth are those who claim to be a Christian, who gossip and lie and swear and use profanity. These are the ones we need to sit down and make them memorize James chapter 3. Over and over and over again, so that every morning they wake up, that chapter is right there in front of their face. It teaches how to control our fiery tongue. What about worry? We know we're not supposed to worry, but we all do it. God made us a promise. The Hebrew writer wrote it down, Hebrews 13, verse 5, that the Lord never will leave us or forsake us. He's always there. Psalms 18, verse 19, David writes that he delivers us because he delights in us. To be a Christian and worry is a problem. If the world sees us as extremely neurotic, what do you think God sees us as? I got to claim that preachers that fall into this category are ones who complain too often. God made us a promise. David wrote it down. Psalms 91. He shall call upon me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble, I will deliver him and honor him. We're to cast our cares upon him. I know it's kind of difficult when, you know, it seems like the money runs out before the checks run out. And we, because of no fault of our own, we might have our backs against the wall too many times. But there's always a way out that God gives us. I think many of us have been in this situation before where we don't know what's going to happen next. And we worry ourselves to no end. And when it's finally all done and over with, we say, well, that wasn't as bad as I thought. Paul in Philippians chapter 2, he commands us to do all things without murmurings or disputings, or without complaining. How do we convert our neighbors if we're pessimists? How do we talk to our neighbors about Christ and the joys of living the Christian life if we're constantly in doubt? Happy is that people whose God is Lord. This is the epitome of a Christian, and we read of it in the 144th Psalm. Happy is that people whose God is Lord. When I think of Paul sitting in a Roman prison, and I'm sitting in my home when it's 20 degrees outside, and I'm not wearing any socks, and I'm drinking a glass of cold tea, and I'm comfortable. If Paul can rejoice in the prison cell, can I rejoice in my own home and be thankful for the blessings that I truly have? The one sin I've always, growing up, had problems understanding, and that was covetousness. I really wasn't sure, a lot of times growing up, what it really meant. I didn't think it was wrong to really want something really bad. But if we look at the history of the early church, this was probably one of the first sins that reared its ugly head. There was a couple, Ananias and Sapphira. Most of us know the account. They had promised to sell property and give it to the church, to the coffers, to give so that they could help. But the money that they received, they reported to the others a lesser amount. They coveted the profits. They weren't being true. And it led to their ruin. Actually, it led to their deaths. Because they didn't lie to men, they lied to the Holy Spirit. They lied to God. We are only to be pilgrims in this world. We're just passing through. Maybe it's a blessing that God only gives us a short time here. Can you imagine living to the age of Methuselah in this world? Do you know how difficult life would be? Hitting the 700 mark and you're sitting there, God still hasn't taken me out of this place yet. How much more does he think I can endure? We're looking for an eternal city in the presence of God. So we're just kind of traipsing through this place, trying to get, I like to put it as, trying to get from this end to that end with our soul intact. And that's the hardest part. The beginning and the end are great. It's the middle that causes all the problems. Just ask Kaylin what she's thinking about right now. She's got it made. I don't have to get up to feed. I can sleep whenever I want to sleep. Nobody's telling me, are you going to sleep all day? No. She's got it made. And then the hard part comes. You grow up. Then there are things that you want. All these things in life, in this world, as we're traipsing through, all of these things that we want to grab hold of, that we want to possess, will be dissolved. There will be nothing left when God returns. When His Son comes for us, everything is going to go. My Mercury Sable is not going with me. My teller machine card is not going with me. My bank account, it's not with me anyway, but that's okay. But it's all gone. But yet those are the things that people put all the effort into. They claim to love Christ and for the cause for which he died. But only when it suits and when it's convenient. They want to be the cheerful giver on Sundays. But are they? You know, we hear so much in the denominational world about tithing. Well, we have to tithe. They truly don't understand what they're talking about. Because if we had to tithe today, they would be in trouble. Because they're not just given 10% of their paycheck. They're given 10% of everything. Their food, everything. And not only 10%, but the best of everything. Israel didn't give the malformed animals of their flock. They gave those that was without blemish, the best they had. The ones that would rend blue ribbons at the fairs. We look at the talents of certain people and how they focus that talents into the world and don't put that talent into Christ. What about those who have the gift of speaking? Then again, on the other side, there are those that have a gift of speaking that waste it away on frivolous things, even within the church. How much covetousness did Christ show when where he lay down at night? What was he happy with? Here was one who could have had whatever he wanted. Anytime he wanted. He only had to speak it and it would be so. But he was satisfied with what he had. What was there at the moment? Everything he had was borrowed. Even a place to lay down his head was offered by somebody else. He didn't just take it. He didn't go up there and say, "You have to give me this because I'm the Son of God." He let it up to others. Colossians 3 and verse 5, it says that covetousness is a form of idolatry. Because it is idolatry, it has to be crucified. It has to be slain and buried deep. Because it is the vanity that destroys the soul. David learned the lessons the hard way in his life. Here was a man after the heart of God. Here was a man who showed his covetousness before the world in a way that was truly ugly. What he wanted and took belonged to someone else. And he murdered to have what was not his because he desired it. But he learned lessons about that. The 119th Psalm, you can read verses 67 through 71, where he thought it was good that he was afflicted, that he was punished for these things. because it brought to the forefront the true nature of what he had done and the destruction that it causes. I don't think there's anybody in the scriptures that could bring home this message with any greater authority than Job. He didn't covet what he had. God gave it to him. But when Satan took it all away, he was still content. Was he distressed? Yes, he was distressed. Because not only was his wealth taken away, but his family. Not only was his family taken away, wealth was taken away. But he still loved God. And he knew where his blessings came from. If we lost everything that we have this very day, would our attitude be the same? In Job chapter 27 and verse 8, Job said, "For what is the hope of a hypocrite, though he hath gained when God taketh away his soul?" And then at the end of the book, chapter 42, verse 12, we can read what Job's righteous trust in God resulted in the end. Everything that Job started out with, because of his love of God and his faith, was even more given back to him. We see a lot of people that wear the title Christians, but we see very few out of that whole category who are sincere and genuine. Other than the letter H, hypocrisy and hell have a lot more in common than we can imagine. If there is anyone here this evening who has a genuine concern for their soul, that things need to be made right with God, we want to give you that opportunity. If you're not a child of God, meaning, if you haven't obeyed the gospel as God laid out in His Word, we want to give you that opportunity also. If you need to know more about it, we want to share that with you. We want to be able, when Christ comes again, to travel together to our final destination, a destination of joy and happiness. The Bible says we'll know one another in heaven. And I truly believe that. We're not going to look the same as we look now, because what goes to heaven is not this. Thank goodness I won't have to go to the barber shop again. But our spirit, our soul, and we will know one another. And those we have left behind will be gone from our thoughts. Because God promised us that there will be no tears in heaven, no sorrow, only joy and happiness. That won't come if we remember loved ones left behind. We want everyone to be there. We want a full house. Christ is preparing us mansions in the house of God. And I want him to work overtime, because I want him to realize that I got to build more rooms, because there's a lot more folks coming. If anyone has a need, we want to provide you with that opportunity now, as together we stand and we sing.